And I have to talk about insight sooner or later, because people keep complaining, Ajahn Brahm only teaches samatha, he never teaches insight, there's no way we can become enlightened. So today's talk is about insight. I mentioned, I forget when, just a day or two ago, talking about the two man and woman, Vipassana, Samatha, and the dog metta always going together. And this is the wonderful part about Buddhism. There aren't two types of meditation, or three, or four, or five, or six types of meditation. They're all exactly the same. They're all about what I said earlier, having a cup of water, putting it down, so it can become still. And if you want to know what insight comes from when you are still, if you go and see the lake and there are waves on the surface of the lake, you can't get a true reflection of the moon and stars above. Only when the lake is perfectly still will you get an accurate reflection of what's around and surrounding it. And that's a very nice simile, because the Buddha said, not once but many times, this is a Pali version, Samadhi Pachya Yata Bhutayana Dasana. From stillness, the mind sees things as they truly are. So it is the activities, and the activity is caused by wanting, which causes the inability to see what's really happening. And another simile, which I say every retreat. I keep saying the same similes because they're the best which I can come up with, and they also let you know through an anecdote exactly what insight is and how it happens. And that is the simile of walking up the hill towards Bodhinyana Monastery. Some of you have probably heard this many times, but I guarantee you haven't heard it as many times as I have. So I get bored with it as well, but it's important. And there I was walking up that hillside for the first time in about 7 years. I've been going up and down in a car, but the first time I decided on a nice spring morning, I asked the driver to please let me out at the bottom. These days they refuse to do that. People come and say, oh no, I need to make merit. Oh, you must sit in my car. Please don't walk. That's why I'm fat. You don't allow me to do exercise. Anyway, there I was walking up the hillside. And as I was walking up the hillside, a place where I'd lived for 7 years, I always remember the experience. I just could not recognize my surroundings. It was like I was walking up a different road, a different hill. I could not understand why I'd never seen all this stuff before. And it was such a weird experience that, you know, I'm sure you do the same. You'd stop and wonder what the heck's going on. When I stopped and stared, then I started to see an even more different hillside. Only when I stopped could I start to see everything which was out there on that hillside. And I also recall it becoming incredibly beautiful when I stopped. And of course you start to think afterwards. This is the insight which comes from the contemplation. Whenever you have a strange, weird, strong experience, of course, I don't know how anyone could not start thinking about it and contemplating it. So I was contemplating it. Why was this happening? Why 7 years up and down that road in a car, and I thought I knew my surroundings, and now it was like I was walking up it literally for the first time. And it was a very simple explanation. It's just ordinary science. It's the way that when light reaches the back of your eye, it's a chemical reaction. It takes a time, a few seconds, to form a full image. But when you're looking through the window of a car, you have one image forming on the back of your eye, not fully formed at all, and that's knocked out by another image which comes, and then another image, and then another image. When you're looking through the window of a car, when it's even only going only 60 kilometers an hour, still the images flow one after the other so fast, there is not one which is fully developed. So the details are not there. nor are the colours. They're not fully formed. They just simply don't have time. And when I walk, I've got more time. So the image actually forms with more detail. You literally see more rocks, more blades of grass, and the colour is deeper, it's richer. And the best of all, when I stopped, that is when I had all the time I needed to have a full image formed in the back of my eye on the retina, and for my mind to have all the time it needed to explore it. And I started to see things which I never imagined existed in that hillside. I'd missed them. And of course, because the colours were fully formed, they were rich. As compared to like pastel colours, washed out colours, when you're looking through the window of a car. So never think that when you're looking through a car, you can understand the scenery. If ever you go on a holiday somewhere and they go in a coach and they go through the Grand Canyon or Niagara Falls or some rolling scenery, and you go and look through the window, you're not seeing it. You're only seeing a fraction of what's out there. Get out of the coach, stand still, and you see so much more. Now that is giving one of the first indications why, if you want to have insight, you have to be still. When the senses are moving so fast, from one to the other, or the images are moving so fast in front of you, literally nothing fully forms. It's only a half, a quarter, maybe a tenth of the information actually gets into your senses. And also, the fascinating little extra is nothing is rich, nothing is powerful. It's just like even the taste of the food. You know, if you're just shoveling it into your mouth rather than pausing, you just miss so much of the taste. If you're running to, you know, to get into the talk on time, you know, you can't appreciate just the feeling of the warmth of the sun on your skin. Only when you go slow, especially when you stop, can you really start to feel what life is all about. And also you start to see some of the detail. So it's the stillness. I'm going to put another quality in the middle before insight. Yes, it's true that stillness is the cause of seeing things as they truly are. Samadhi, which is stillness, is the cause for seeing things as they truly are, for insight. But one of the reasons is because it's the stillness which is the cause for mindfulness. And mindfulness is an important quality in meditation. And in fact, it is emphasized more than anything else in modern meditation in the West. It's overly emphasized. Yeah, it is important. But there's other things which are as or even more important than mindfulness. And not only the other things more important, that sometimes it's not really explained just how to develop that mindfulness, how to make it strong. And for those of you who've read Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, where I wanted to really emphasize what mindfulness is, I gave this idea of the different powers of mindfulness. Because everybody is mindful. I told someone the other day, even someone who's drunk, they're mindful enough to find their way home. How they do that, even they don't know. But they've got enough mindfulness, the last little piece of mindfulness, to be able to find their way home. So yeah, they are mindful to a degree, but no, that's not very good mindfulness. And you, when you are just, you know, not drinking, when you're driving the car to work, you're mindful enough to, you know, miss all the other traffic, to know where the speed cameras are and to keep within the limits. You're aware enough. But is that all that mindfulness is? Is that all you need to do to become enlightened? Just that common or garden type of mindfulness which everybody has? And of course not, because you will also experience on a retreat like this, I hope, that when you get stillness, your mindfulness increases in power. The mindfulness gets stronger. What do I mean by the mindfulness getting stronger? I mean that just like looking through the window of a car, you tend to see more of what's around you. You begin to taste more flavors in the breakfast. You can hear more sounds of the birds. And you can actually see more little rocks or whatever else, you know, is in the compound. I might as well take this down now, because somebody last November, they picked this one up, they saw it on the ground here. They picked it up because they noticed there's a little bit of gold on the rocks. Because in these hills, there is gold. There is gold in these hills. And it's not enough to make it commercially viable. There's a gold mine further south. But they notice, you know, these rocks which have come from the quarry, they notice there's a little bit of gold in it. Now, you can only do that if you're mindful, because you start to see things. Hey, what's that? A lot of time it's just, you know, gravel, and you just go past it. But this is usually what happens when you get mindful. You can actually see more things. And the nice part about it, what you see, again, is richer, more beautiful. That means actually you get alive. That's what you feel after the end of a retreat. You're really alive. You're actually in life. You've got powerful mindfulness now. So what you see is also more delightful. You get a free form of happiness, just the joy in being alive. The opposite of super mindfulness or power mindfulness is the old depression. Because when you're depressed, nothing tastes nice. When you're depressed, you know, everything, even the brightest of colours, is all washed out. And you know, the music which you like the most is just meh. This is, you know, one of the problems with depression. The mindfulness is so weak. You know, nothing is enjoyable at all. Everything is just really grey, tasteless, bland. Now the opposite of that is where, you know, you get a very strong mindfulness and everything is beautiful. And there's heaps of stories about, you know, what you can expect. You know, bamboo floor which you're sitting on. When your mindfulness gets really, really strong, you look at that, it's incredibly beautiful. You know, this is an old bamboo floor. What's the difference there? You know, there's wood all over the place. But you look at it, or maybe you have some the bamboo in your hut, and it's incredibly beautiful. You can see so many different colours of brown. And it becomes so beautiful, you can just watch it for a long period of time. And there was an old poem which I remember from the time I was a student. You know, by the 17th century British, he's supposed to be a mystic and also a very good artist as well, William Blake. And his one stanza of his poem, which is very well known, is to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, an eternity in an hour. To see a world in a grain of sand, see a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, an eternity in an hour. That's a very evocative poem. And you understand that what he was up to, whether it was through some drugs or some ability to actually to get really powerfully mindful, this is what happens. You know, a grain of sand, you can see so much in that. That's a sign you've got powerful mindfulness. You're seeing things which most people cannot see. It's just a grain of sand, you pass it by. But you stop. And you allow it to open up to you. Because you're still, you start seeing more and more. I did give that simile the other day. What is this? No, it's a stick. Gone. See how fast you are in your knowing? You keep still with it, and it's amazing what you can see. After, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, it's amazing what you can see. And this is a sign that you are becoming aware. And I say a grain of sand, but they say like a wild flower. A flower is naturally beautiful. A wild flower is a tiny thing. We have lots of wildflowers here in Western Australia. They're very famous because we haven't got any other flowers. That's all you got, so you sort of overemphasize them. But sometimes you can pass them by so quickly. But if you stop and look at the wildflowers when the season comes, they are incredibly beautiful. But you have to be very patient and still to see it. And this is what the fellow was meaning. When you get mindful, you start to see much more. And it's not just to see a world, you see a heaven there as well. What you see is very, very pleasant. So, you know, when we're doing this stillness, this letting go and allowing the mind, you know, to stop moving, you're developing a lot of powerful mindfulness, and it will result in you seeing these incredibly beautiful things in your life. And that's a sign that you are ready for insight. Because you can't just get insight just with your normal mindfulness. If that was the case, everybody would be enlightened. There are people far more intelligent than us, you know, in the universities. But I wondered, why don't they ever get real insight? And it's because they know how to think, but they don't know how to be still and see. So here we're learning how to be still, seeing, feeling, and knowing. And this is where we get our insight from. Now what do we actually mean by the insight? The deeper you get in your meditation, you know, once you get past the dullness, once the energy starts coming up, once you can start to see, you first get insight into, you know, the way the meditation works. Because there are all these problems in meditation. Now we don't look at those things as something to get rid of and discard. They are a problem because they are teaching you something. There's something you haven't seen yet. That's why it's a problem. So when you do have any difficulty in meditation, this is the coal face of insight, as they say. This is where insight grows from, the problems in meditation. You know, if you're going fine and go all the way into jhanas really quickly, yeah, I mean, that's great fun. But you don't really learn much on the way. So you start simple things, just how to have a comfortable body. And getting the insight into that, that's really valid insight, and it is incredibly useful in your daily life. Because that's the other question which people will ask, and they ask it usually in the next couple of days. Yeah, this is all very good, but what's this got to do with my daily life? How can I practice this when I go home? You know, just learning how to be healthy, for goodness sake. You know, learning how to relax your body. I tell this story again, it's one of my favorite stories because it was quite recent. You know, only about 2.5 years ago, I had this terrible food poisoning. And I was in my cave on the opposite side of the road, rolling on the floor in agony. I couldn't sit still. Oh! Oh! Well, much worse than that, you know. I'm not a very good actor. I'm a monk, you know. I'm supposed to be honest, that's why I can't really act. But, ooh! And, you know, it was getting worse and worse. Any sane person would have called a doctor and gone to hospital, but, you know, monks are not that sane sometimes. It's just too much bother going to hospital. So, you get to a point as a monk, as a teacher, you know, when you start to think, okay, what would I tell other people to do? I wish I'd do that straight away. But, you know, a long time, you wait for a while until you're, you know, really stupid. And what would I tell others to do? And I say, I tell them to just be mindful and be kind. So, you know, I did what I tell other people to do. So, you know, I, instead of rolling around and going, ooh, ooh, I was just aware of that pain. Being aware means you have to let it be. Otherwise, you're not running away from it. If you're running away from the ghost, from the demon, you're not looking at the demon. You're running in the opposite direction. So you have to face the demon of pain. And the most important thing, it's not just mindfulness. That does not work. Kindfulness. Please, please, please add this beautiful kindness. The door of my heart is open to you, pain. You're okay. Doesn't matter. That beautiful sense of loving kindness. Compassion. No care. That softness. And the nice thing about mindfulness, it does give you feedback. You notice whether the pain gets worse, the same, or better. And this is important because I could see the pain getting slightly less intense. That was a feedback. That's all I needed. Yes, this is the path. Carry on being kind. And so I just carried on. Moment by moment, you know, the pain got a tiny bit less, a tiny bit less. And it only took me 20 minutes. I remember that because I had a clock there and I saw it. And it was amazing. After 20 minutes, all the pain had totally vanished. Nothing left, not even a slight ache at all. It was as if you were as healthy as could be. No food poisoning, no tummy ache, nothing. It was just all, back to normal, good, healthy body. And only 20 minutes that took. And of course, that blissed you out, and it's great you can do those things as a monk. And it means that it showed me just the power. This was the insight into how to relax my body, and I could use it in a very difficult situation. But also, I had to try and think, what was going on there? Because ask any doctor, food poisoning is some bacteria which is playing havoc in your guts. So I imagined, I visualized, I like visualizing. I was visualizing all these bacteria. I never really seen a bacteria, but there's these cells with all these tentacles coming off them. That's how I imagined it. And I imagined all these tentacles, were now cross-legged in full lotus, and all the bacteria were meditating peacefully. Instead of messing around with my tummy. And that's how I imagined it. I will learn how to meditate. So they left me alone. But anyway, it never came back again. So that was telling me just how just little mindfulness of your body and the kindness, you get the insight into how to relax your own body to the point that aches and pains and even sicknesses, even diseases, can be at least lessened, if not totally overcome. You're getting an understanding of the connection, the insight into the connection between your mind and your body. Now ask any doctors about the placebo effect. It's just so well known. Remember one of these articles, I don't know how these doctors got away with this. This was over in the United States of all places where the lawyers could make a billion out of this sort of stuff. They had a group of people with bad knees. And half of them, they gave the operation, to whatever it was. And the other half, they just made the incision and then sewed it up again immediately. So no operation at all. But it looked like they had an operation. And the people who looked like the operation did almost just as well as they actually had the operation. And they just basically, I've had an operation, I must be okay now. And that placebo effect actually worked. And you might say, how on earth does that work? And it is the interaction between the mind and the body. You're getting insight into this in this meditation. And that's a powerful insight to have. And how you can let go of this body. And now you get the insight. Why on earth is it that you can't let go of all this stuff which happened to you in your past? It's gone. And the most crazy thing is that it wasn't your fault. Someone else cheated you, messed you around, betrayed you. They did the bad karma, but why are you suffering for it? And the reason is because you're stupid. It is the case. Why can't you let it go? It's not your fault. But we get the insight into the fact that how much we hold on to pain of the past. And we should at least get the insight in this retreat. And the insight is the great wisdom comes up one day. And it's amazing insight. Say, I don't need to keep thinking about that past. It's as simple as it is. I just don't have to do this anymore. For some reason, you've been conditioned to actually to believe that, yes, if there's a problem in the past, you have to fix it. That you have to learn from it. You have to get revenge or whatever it is you want to do. But you're not allowed, as if it's against some unwritten law, just to forgive, walk on and let it go. But on this retreat, because letting go is emphasized so much, especially the past, one day it will just dawn on you. I don't have to do this anymore. I can actually let it go. I don't have to think about it and solve it and re-experience it. I can just untie this rope which ties me to the past and just let it just drift off into oblivion. Now, I remember talking to many psychologists about this and having discussions with them. And they said that's one of the most radical ideas in psychology. The fact that you don't have to bring up the past, relive it, work it all out, you know, accept it and then let it go. You can let it go straight away. And you get insight for that. You can do it. Why not? It's not my past. So why do I have to bother with it? Now, those are powerful insight. It is an insight which you learn by just a little bit of practice, a little bit of courage. You let go of that past here. And it becomes one of the first insights into things like non-self. You know, a lot of times that, you know, especially people who read the Buddhist books, yeah, they know anatta. They can even spell it in Pali. And there they know, you know, they can describe it and what sutta it's in. But do they really know what it is? And here you're actually experiencing what this is. You're letting go of the past. And you know, for many people, that is what they make their sense of self as. That becomes who you take yourself to be. Me, I am a physicist. I did physics at Cambridge University. You know, that's such a long time ago. I've forgotten most of it. And actually, if I do remember those days, I don't remember the physics. I remember the parties. And I'm studying. It's not the physics at all. That's the only thing I remember. But, you know, so you're not a physicist anymore. No, you're not. You know, am I English? I was born in London. Am I English? And it's great being, you know, in my position right now, because you do travel all over the world and you do have a lot of good friends. I have my societies and groups in many different countries, and I was always very touched, and I was honest when this happened. I was at an international conference, I think it was in Vietnam, and for some strange reason I was not representing Australia, I was representing Singapore. Because I've got a big group over there, and they knew I went to Singapore a lot, so they put my name down as part of the Singapore delegation, even though I was sitting with the Australians, because they were my mates. But as I walked out of the convention centre, they had the Malaysian delegation were having their official photograph taken. And they had this really huge, you know, Malaysian flag. As I walked past, and you know, all the sort of the monks and the lay people at the delegation were standing, you know, behind the flag. And one of them saw me. Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, come over here. And I said, I can't go into that photograph. I'm representing Singapore and I'm Australian. I'll get confused. He said, no, you're one of us. And I really enjoyed that. You know, so I had right in the center, you know, amongst the, you know, the big monks, in the Malaysian delegation to a conference in Vietnam where I was representing Singapore and coming from Australia. Who the hell am I? And it's lovely because you don't associate with being a particular race. And even none of you were there last Friday at Dhammaloka. Apparently at the Nolamara Centre, while I was here on Friday teaching the first talk, Ajahn Brahmali was at Dhammaloka Centre giving a talk. And he was giving a talk, apparently, according to the people who were there, about gender equality. And he was mentioning that the Buddha, the best Buddha statues, they don't have a gender. You know, you look at their face, are they masculine or feminine? And so when you really do lots of meditation, you don't even know what their gender is, said Ajahn Brahmani. He said, just like Ajahn Brahm, I don't know what gender he is. And I did not know whether to take that which way. And it's true. I mean, when you become a monk, you don't mess around with those things. And it's absolutely true because, again, when you go traveling, you go to some of these airports and they haven't got, you know, the toilets haven't got the name in English on. I haven't got a clue what, was it, Tandas is, that's the Malaysian for toilet. And we know what is a man, for man and female. So the only thing you do, at least they have these little stick figures on the outside. And I look at that stick figure and I look at me and I go in the wrong cubicle. Later, who am I? So you can see from that, that's all your past. You know, and are you a good meditator or a bad meditator? How many of you are not being able to get into great meditation because of some experience you had before? A lot of you. And you just let that go. Just maybe you may have had a jhana before. That is not going to help at all for the next meditation you're going to do in a few minutes. So that we get this great insight to let go. I am not what I experienced in the past. Just letting go. And letting go of the future. Now this is just simple insight, but sometimes the simple ones are the most powerful. The future. Who are you going to be? I haven't got a clue. You don't know if you're going to be alive in the next few moments. You don't know if you're going to be enlightened in the next few moments. When people keep saying, well, when I go home to work, what am I going to do? If you become enlightened, I'm sorry, but you can't go back to work. You think, oh, you know, what am I going to do when, you know, when my husband, my wife? If you become an arahat in the next few days, I'm sorry. There's no choice. There was this man who did become, he became an arahat. And he had, this is in the time of the Buddha, he had three wives at the time. You know, they had these many wives. And he told them, look, darlings, you know, there's no way I can sort of be your husband anymore. You know, I'm now an arahat, I've got to become a monk. And said, you can do whatever you want. You know, you can actually, if you want to become a nun with me, you can be. If you want to go home to your parents, or if you want, I can find you another guy if you want. An amazing one, and said, yes, another one please. Not you, but this guy over there, which I've been looking at for a long time. And so he's very happy he arranged the marriage for her. But there's no way he could actually go back to his wife. So all the plans which you are making about what you do when you go home, who knows? A total waste of time. One of the great stories and anecdotes about the stupidity of the future and thinking about it so we can just let it go. And this guy came and told me this over in Bodhinyana quite a few years ago now. He was a businessman doing some business in India, in Mumbai. And he was a guy who finished his business, got the hotel to organize a taxi for him, in plenty of time to get to the airport to catch his flight. But when the taxi started going to the airport, it was one of these guys, some migrant, who didn't know the streets of Bombay at all and got totally lost. And it's a really big city, Bombay. And the guy was totally lost. He couldn't find the way to the airport. Now, minutes were going past and they were getting further and further away. No one knew where they were. He was going to miss his plane. And he was really anxious. What would happen if he missed his plane? If any of you have been late for the airport, or some of you, you know, once you leave here, get to the airport in time, you think. And when the taxi gets lost or you get stuck in a traffic jam, you get really anxious. He was getting more and more anxious because, you know, it was really getting very close to the cut-off time. After a certain time, you just cannot check in. He thought he was really going to miss his plane. But in those days, you know, being India, many of the flights were actually delayed. So he thought, it's probably I'll be okay because they're usually delayed. But for once, his flight was on time because he saw it take off. When he got close enough to the airport, he saw his flight sort of rise up into the air as it took off. And you could tell from the tail. He was so angry at the taxi driver. You stupid taxi driver, you stupid man, you made me lose my flight. You're a taxi driver, you should know India. From a hotel, it's an easy way to go. Why have you lost this way? And as he was getting angry at the taxi driver, he saw the flight which he should have been on come crashing down to the ground where everybody was killed. You wonderful taxi driver. I love you so much. How much tip do you want? Have the whole wallet. And it really started to show you that because the future is so uncertain, you know, why get anxious for this future? So can you get the insight in this retreat not to worry about what's going to happen next? Because you don't know which way it's going to come out. Letting go of the past, letting go of the future gives you an enormous sense of freedom. You get the insight into being here. What's it actually like to be a human being? Number one, you find so much of your suffering, the anxiety, the anger, the guilt, the fear, all of that just vanishes from you. You get the insight into how you can be alive. Now these are great insights. Insights on the path. Insights on how to let go of the past and the future. You have to do that. You can't just plan it. You experience it, it happens, and you learn. That is insight. Now, you're getting even more. If you can't do that, why? Keep asking that question. If you can't let go of the past, or you can't let go of the future so far, why? What's the problem? Is it fear? A lot of time it is fear. It's fear of, again, like the simile of the prison, going to a place you've never been before. The place which you just don't know. Yeah, the old place may be suffering, but at least I know it. So that gives you a sense of comfort. But going to places you don't know, even though they're beautiful, is a bit sort of challenging. So you have to be courageous if you want to be free. Courageous to give it a try. What's it like? Just to not have any thinking. You know, one of the reasons is that we think too much because we don't know anything else. But on this retreat, little by little, you may have those moments of silence. Maybe a minute, maybe less, maybe more. But there's not a thought going on in your mind. And because we've emphasized that, you notice it. When you notice it, you go, hey, this is beautiful, this is wonderful. In the old days, silence was respected. You could go off into the bush in Australia and it'd be totally silent. You wouldn't hear any sound at all. I remember one of my experiences, you know, going to visit England many years ago as a monk in this monastery in the winter time. It's a very stupid thing to do. If you go to Europe, please don't go in November, December, January. It's depressing. It's freezing. Go in the summertime if you want to go to visit Poland. When it's nice and green and warm and everything is nice. But I went in the winter time and that year was really cold. Minus 26 degrees centigrade was the night before. And that morning I went out for a walk. It wasn't minus 26 then, but pretty cold. They only say only mad dogs and English monks go out into such cold weather. So off I went, the mad monk. And it was one of the most memorable experiences of my life. It was so cold that no one else was out. There was no cars. I think all the aircraft were grounded. And all the animals, the birds, the animals were all hibernating. I had the whole planet to myself. That's what it felt like. When I stopped crunching the snow, there was no sound at all. Everything stopped. And my mind stopped as well. And then, I don't know how many minutes, then you started doing your next step. And it was magic. The magic of absolute silence. When you get into it, that has a pleasure, a delight, which is intense. You feel just so relieved and so free. When there's not a thought, not a sound going on around you. And it's, you know, you're listening intently because I'm resonating with that in you. The times when there's nothing going on. Peace at last. Now you're getting insight into the beauty of silence, its power. I know this guy Eckhart Tolle did The Power of Now. He did another book. I was expecting him to do the next stage, The Power of Silence. but he did something else. Silence is the next level up. It's intense, it's beautiful, and it's like pregnant with incredible wisdoms and insights. It's one of the reasons why if you have enough experience of the silence in the mind or the silence outside, you will realize that wisdom is always born of silence, never of thinking. Once you understand that, once you get that insight, you will never try and solve the problems of life or the world or your own problems by thinking about them. We waste so much time and get so much suffering by trying to find answers through thought. And all we ever get is half-truths which we argue about. Isn't it wonderful to be able to just be silent and then see the truth and then get the answer? And that's answers you never argue with. They are the truth. And if you're coming in here for insight to the truth, it has to be through silence. So, what's the next thing which happens in this meditation? If you can't be silent, again, it's fear of silence. Fear of being out of your comfort zone, as they say. And how do you overcome fear? You just go a little bit further into it and then you come back again. The parole of the prisoner. Just go out for a few hours and you can come back again. A few more hours, come back again until you get used to it. Until you realize this is actually a nice place to be outside of jail. So you go a bit further into the meditation and you understand, well, why can't I be still all the time? What's stopping me? Only I get the insight. Now, what I've been teaching all this time is, what is the problem? It's all this wanting business. That's why you can't be still. Now, sometimes for meditation, I ask people to start off their meditation, especially in guided meditations. Can you now please remember the most peaceful experience you've ever had in your whole life so far? The most meaningful spiritual experience, if you like to call it that. Where was it? What time? What was around? What time of day? Now, when you build up that memory of the most incredible, peaceful, still, wonderful spiritual experience you've ever had, then ask, why was it so amazing? And you will find that there is a great degree of contentment. A time when you never wanted to be with anybody else except the person you were with. A time when you never wanted anything more in the whole world except what you had. A time when you had no plans to go anywhere, no regrets. You were totally content just to be here in this moment with who you were with in that time, in that place. You'll notice it's the most powerful experience because all you're wanting had subsided for a few minutes. You were satisfied. You'd arrived. You were home. You didn't need anything. Everything was there. So you never wanted. That was why it was intense. And here you'll have those moments too. Moments of perfect peace in the meditation. Incredibly still and happy. Content. Why? The insight will arise because all the wanting, for some reason or another, has subsided and become still. And you're incredibly happy. It's giving some insight into what I call, I said there's only one type of meditation, but actually I was a bit wrong there. There are two types of meditation. Please get this insight. And then you'll be on the path. The insight of the two types of meditation. And I call those two types of meditation second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation. For those of you who know your Buddhism, the four noble truths. First is the truth of suffering. The second noble truth, the cause of suffering. Is desire, wanting, craving. So, if on this retreat so far, you've been having a lot of suffering, frustration, disappointment, unhappiness, you, my friend, have been doing second Noble Truth Meditation. You're suffering because you wanted something. Just like the Buddha said, wanting is the cause of suffering. That is not the type of meditation recommended in this joint. Instead, we recommend third Noble Truth Meditation. So if then when you go home and you ask and tell your friends, oh, what type of meditation does Ajahn Brahm teach? Please tell them, don't tell them Samatha or Jhana or whatever. Tell them he teaches third Noble Truth Meditation. Third Noble Truth, letting go of craving is the cause for Nibbana. The ultimate happiness. Letting go of all wanting. That is third Noble Truth Meditation. So you're fast asleep and happy to be asleep. That is third Noble Truth Meditation. You're not fighting anymore. You're not wanting. You're not trying to control. And just like that story I said the other day about that monk the Buddha saw who was half asleep, and the Buddha smiled, and 2 weeks later that monk was fully enlightened with psychic powers. Because he was doing the right type of meditation. It's only a matter of time. So, do the third Noble Truth Meditation. And if you get insight into that, just that and nothing else for this whole retreat, I will be incredibly happy. You know, you've got the path. You understand how to meditate and how to become enlightened. And you'll have so many moments of so much happiness. Just happy to be here, peaceful. You don't need, one of the things about remembering that happiest experience of your life so far of contentment, you didn't need to be filthy rich to have some hot chick next to you. You didn't need to have the best food. You didn't need to have a big condominium. You didn't need to be on the beach somewhere in some six-star resort. You found you could be content with just simple things. It's nothing to do with what you have. Everything to do with what you want. You're learning a great insight into four noble truths, the truth of suffering. When you're content, when you don't want, you also get the insight into viraga, things fading away. In one of the books, you know, from some of my talks, which Ajahn Brahmali very brilliantly edited and collected together, and he gave this really wonderful title called The Art of Disappearing. And it's a great title for the path to enlightenment. People think enlightenment is the path to, not to disappearing, but getting more things. To be an arahat, to be the star, to be the bodhisattva of the age, to be someone. That is not the path of Buddhism. It's a path of disappearing, of vanishing, of being a no one. Disappearing. That's the path. And that is a word for that, viraga. This is what happens when you see the truth. Things start to disappear and vanish. It's not a path of attaining. It's a path of letting go. A path of vanishing. Wow. Now, so you get the insight. You're not trying to get things. You're trying to actually lessen things. To vanish more and more and more. And you know, the less you have, the less you have to worry about. You don't have to be intelligent. You don't have to be funny. I try and I fail. I succeed sometimes. You don't have to be anything. You can disappear. Now that gives you the insight into, again, some more of this thing about non-self. One of the things, the insights you get, is actually, again, where the sense of self comes from, its cause. You find the past and the future, that creates yourself, what you define yourself to be. But also the other thing which defines you is this struggle and striving. You ever seen that people who struggle and strive and win, they're the ones who get the medals, they're the ones who go on the podiums, they're the ones in the front covers of magazine, the winners, the beautiful people. And if you ever met any of those highly successful people, they're pains in the butt, they've got such huge egos. The higher you get in the company, usually, the more you succeed, the more of a, that hole in the bottom you become. It's true, isn't it? Why is that? It's because, through that struggling, they get a bigger and bigger and bigger ego. It's the struggle and striving is what makes the sense of self. The more you do, the more you control, the bigger you are. Which is why, in this meditation retreat, you don't struggle and strive. You let go. You're going in a totally strange and weird direction. When you don't struggle and strive, when you let go, you disappear more. In the jhanas, you're almost totally gone. Vanished. That's why they're incredible states. Afterwards, where the hell am I? Who am I? Everything you ever thought you were is not there. If you try and achieve things, work hard, it just makes a bigger illusion of a self. It makes it more solid. Letting go allows it all to vanish and disappear. And you bliss out. You're getting some great insight into anatta. But the greatest of insights, the ones which make you enlightened, and the reason why this path of jhanas, in my experience, opinion, is the only way you can ever get even to be a stream winner, let alone the arahats and the anagamis. No, this is controversial because it's not supported, it's not contradicted by the sutras, but it's not really supported by it either. Do you need a jhana to become a stream winner? I can't see any other way. This is why. It's my simile of the tadpole and the frog. It's one of the great similes of what insight is and why you need jhanas to get the big insights. Once there was a little tadpole, and a little tadpole. Did I tell the story earlier? About. Okay. Sorry? No, it's not in the teaching. Once a little tadpole, and this little tadpole grew up in a lake just in the bottom of a retreat center. And she grew up in that lake. And when she grew up in the lake, she went to tadpole school. And in tadpole school, she excelled in chemistry. And in tadpole school, she learned that chemistry is H2O. From tadpole school, she went to tadpole university, and she majored in chemistry, where she learned all the incredible molecular structure of water. But even though that she graduated with honors in tadpole university, and thought she knew what water was, actually there was a few frogs in that pond who taught the Abhidhamma about the deeper nature of water. But, do you think the tadpole can understand what water is? No more than a fish can understand what water is, because you were born in water, lived all your life in water. Water's always been there. How can you ever understand it? So intellectually, yeah, H2O, whatever, but you can't really understand it. Now the difference between a tadpole and a fish is a tadpole grows up, and one day little tadpole finds little things growing out of its shoulders and its bottom, its legs and arms. And after many days, those legs and arms get so big that one day little tadpole, now a frog, not really knowing what she's doing, jumps and is now standing on the banks outside of the pond. And that is one of the weirdest experiences the tadpole has ever had. First time out of the lake. And what happens with little tadpole, little frog now? She thinks something is missing. Something which has always been there ever since I can remember has suddenly disappeared. And that's weird. That's water. Now, the frog can understand what water actually is. You can get insight into water once it has vanished. Your body, Do you really understand what your body is and your five senses? Even if you're a doctor, how can you understand what the body is when you've been living in one ever since you can remember? Understand what these five senses are? How can you understand? You can go to lectures, you can cut up other people's bodies, you can see them under a microscope. That's not understanding them. But one day, little tadpoles, some of you have already become frogs. One day, you will jump out of the lake. You get into such a deep meditation, your body is gone. You can't hear, you can't feel, you can't see, you can't even know the body. It's all gone, it's vanished. Those are the jhana experiences. For the first time ever, something is missing. Something which was always there has now gone. Your body and your five senses. Now you have a chance to understand what this human body actually is. There's an opportunity to understand what this sense experience is. Before, no way. Even though I like to be controversial, because it makes people think. Even things like sex. How can you ever understand what that is? Except when the body vanishes and disappears. That is why the vanishing is the great source of real powerful insights. And that will just kick you up the backside so powerfully, you come out and you just see things in a totally different way. But that's only the start. Because in the second of those jhanas, something else is missing. And this is even more powerful and more fascinating. Because in that second experience of jhana, the second jhana, the thing which is missing, which has always been there for you, which you've taken for granted, and I mentioned this yesterday, is your will, choice, the ability to do things, that has vanished, disappeared. And that is really weird. It's not as if you don't decide to exert your will. That's common. Yeah, we've got a will there, but we decide not to let go. We're not going to do anything. You're deciding to let go. But this is totally different. You can't decide or not decide. All the levers of control, all the steering wheels and pedals, all the little mouses which you click to control the screen, they've vanished. Not there anymore. You can't do anything. This thing called will, choice, has totally vanished. You've jumped out of the lake. And it's never been like that ever before. That is weird. That is crazy. But that is so true. Now you have a chance to understand what this will actually is. How can you ever understand what will is, choice, doing, controlling? How can you ever understand what it is when you've been born in it, lived all your life, and it's always been there for you? But one day, you jump out, and that is incredible. This is where you get insight. Well, you know, it's this will, it's not me, nothing to do with me. Even worse, you realize that this will is your biggest enemy. It is not your friend. For years, lifetimes even, you have taken this will, this choice, to be your protector, to save you from damage, from harm. You've taken this will to be the source of your success and happiness. Sometimes the will has made mistakes. But you don't think that the will is wrong, it's just sometimes stupid. Which is why many people come to a place like this, thinking, assuming, if only I can teach the will to be smart, to have more wisdom, to be more mindful. If only my will could be more mindful and smart and wise, then I won't need to suffer anymore. In this meditation you find, no, The will is totally shot. It's a car which cannot be fixed. Its very nature is to cause you suffering. It is the torturer, the prison guard, who never allows you to be still for one moment. You find the will, otherwise known as craving, is suffering. And once you let it go, freedom at last. Freedom from choice. Freedom of choice is our right. It's in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That's what human rights are all about. The ability to do what I want when I want. And you get the great insight that that is a total mess. When the will disappears, you have freedom. But with the will disappearing, you disappear as well. You vanish. That is why it's the vanishing, the art of disappearing. And you get these incredible insights, not small ones, which afterwards spin you out for days. And I hopefully challenged you. Challenge you because, insight is not seeing what you expect to see. Insight is not comfortable. Insight is not reassuring. Insight is bloody challenging and really just makes you just, wow, do I really want this? And most people don't. But it's a bit too late for you now. Sorry. I'm not really that sorry. It really spins you. But you know it's truth. That's the worst part of it. When I was with the Ajahn Chah, I got scared many times. And I wanted to run away, but it was just truth. You couldn't resist it. Now, even though you didn't like it, what that fellow was saying was true. Damn it. And that really gets you in there. So you're getting these great insights. And these insights, it's not something you do, insight. That's more will stuff. Insight is what happens. The frog doesn't decide to notice that water is gone. It's obvious. Something is weird. What is it? You can't avoid seeing it. Which is why it's not you do insight. You get still, still, still. Insight all the way into ordinary things, into refined things of meditation, into ultimate things. Still, 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 all the way. And insight comes. And it blows your mind. Seeing things you never expected to see before. And afterwards, when you realize the world has nothing to do with you, you're totally free. If you think about being irresponsible, now you can truly be irresponsible. Not my fault. I never chose. Nothing to do with me. And then you can really let go. You don't get anything from exerting your willpower. Only more rebirth and more suffering. When you let go, when you disappear, then everything happens. Enlightenment, stillness, peace. That's why I often say, I have to be honest. Sometimes people say, you speak such high Dhamma, jhanas, enlightenment stuff, but Ajahn Brahm, can you do it yourself? Ajahn Brahm, can you get jhanas? And I have to be honest with you. Ajahn Brahm can't get jhanas. I am a hopeless meditator. Ajahn Brahm has to disappear first. I have to and then meditation happens. It's nothing to do with me. I take no responsibility for my meditation. I have to go, vanish. When I go, my will goes. When my I go and my will goes, then it becomes incredibly peaceful. Then those stages happen. But not when I'm around. That's why I often say Ajahn Brahm, he can't meditate for his life. And Ajahn Chah couldn't meditate. And even the Buddha couldn't get jhanas. The Buddha vanished. And then the jhanas happened. Do you understand what I'm talking about? No self, no will, no controlling. You vanish, disappear. And then all these stages happen. That is the insight into non-self. Okay, enough for now. Well, hopefully I've spun you out. But please, for goodness sake, don't try thinking about it and analysing it and thinking, well, because it says this and that, just wait all together. Oh, just shut up. and just enjoy. Okay, so, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.